"You must stall the board," Homer wrote to Nurse Angela. "Tell them that your efforts to reach Dr. Stone are hampered by the doctor being in transit between two of the mission's hospitals in India. Say Assam is one and say New Delhi is the other. Say you don't expect to be able to communicate with him for a week or more, and that, if he was willing to consider the position at St. Cloud's, he couldn't possibly be available before November." Homer Wells hoped that this would allow him the time to tell Angel everything and to be finished with the harvest. "You'll have to convince the board that you are competent midwives, in addition to being good nurses, and that you'll be able to recognize the patients who should be referred to a physician," Homer wrote to Nurse Angela. "You must forgive me for needing all this time, but perhaps I will seem more believable to the Board of Trustees if everyone has to wait for me. It takes time to leave Asia." He also requested that they send him the available history of Fuzzy Stone and tell him anything that Larch might have omitted, although Homer could not imagine that St. Larch had left out anything. It was with the shortest possible sentence that Homer told Nurse Angela that he had loved Larch like a father, and that they had nothing to fear from Melanie. Poor Bob, who had broken her nose and her arm, had plenty to fear from Melanie, however, but Bob wasn't smart enough to be afraid of her. When the cast would come off her arm, and when her nose looked more or less normal again, Melanie and Lorna would cruise the old familiar spots, the pizza bar and bath among them, and Bob would have the charmless instinct to annoy them again. Melanie would disarm him with her shy smile, the one that humbly revealed her bad teeth to him. And while Bob turned his oafish attention to Lorna, Melanie snipped off the top half of his ear with her wire cutters, the electrician's common and trusty tool. Then Melanie broke several of Bob's ribs and his nose and beat him unconscious with a chair. She had her heart in the right place regarding St. Cloud's, but Melanie was an eye for an eye and a tit-for-tat girl. "My hero," Lorna called her. It was a touchy word to use around Melanie, who had long thought that Homer Wells was made of hero stuff. Homer was a hero in Rose's eyes. She spent all of Monday in bed in Angel's room, with Candy bringing her baby to her from time to time, and Angel visiting with her every chance he could get. "You're gonna love this room," Angel told her. "You playing crazy," Rose told him, "but I already love it." It was a day that hurt the harvest. Mr. Rose wouldn't pick, and half the men were sore from falling off the bicycles. Homer Wells, who never would master the terrible machine, had a puffy knee and a bruise between his shoulder blades the size of a melon. Peaches refused to go up a ladder. He would load the trailers and pick drops all day. Muddy groaned and complained. He was the only one among them who had actually learned to ride. Black Pan announced that it was a good day for a fast. Mr. Rose, it appeared, was fasting. He sat outside the cider house in the weak sun, wrapped in a blanket from his bed. He sat Indian style, not talking to anyone. "He say he on a pickin' strike," Peaches whispered to Muddy, who told Homer that he thought Mr. Rose was on a hunger strike, too. "And every other kind of strike they is." "We'll just have to get along without him," Homer told the men. But everyone pussyfooted their way past Mr. Rose, who appeared to have enthroned himself in front of the cider house. "Or else he planted himself like a tree," Peaches said. Black Pan brought him a cup of coffee and some fresh cornbread, but Mr. Rose wouldn't touch any of it. Sometimes he appeared to be gnawing on one of the pacifiers. It was a cool day, and when the faint sun would drift behind the clouds, Mr. Rose would draw the blanket over his head. Then he sat cloaked and robed and closed off completely from any of them. "He like an Indian," Peaches said. "He don't make no treaty." "He want to see his daughter," Muddy informed Homer at the end of the day. "That's what he say to me. It all he say. Just see her. He say he won't touch her." "Tell him he can come to the house and see her there," Homer Wells told Muddy. But at supper time, Muddy came to the kitchen door alone. Candy asked him in and asked him to eat with them. Rose was sitting with them at the table, but Muddy was too nervous to stay. "He say he won't come here," Muddy told Homer. "He say for her to come to the cider house. He say to tell you they got their own rules. He say you breaking the rules, Homer. Rose sat so still at the table that she was not even chewing. She wanted to be sure to hear everything Muddy was saying. Angel tried to take her hand, which was cold, but she pulled it away from him and kept both her hands wound up in her napkin in her lap. "Muddy," Wally said, "you tell him that Rose is staying in my house, and that in my house we follow my rules. You tell him he's welcome to come here any time." "He won't do it," Muddy said.
"I have to go see him," Rose said.
"No, you don't," Candy told her. "You tell him he sees her here or nowhere, Muddy," Candy said.
"Yes, ma'am. I brung the bicycles back," Muddy said to Angel. "They a little banged up."
Angel went outside to look at the bicycles, and that's when Muddy handed him the knife.
"You don't need this, Angel," Muddy told the boy. "But you give it to Rose. You say I want her to have it, just so she have one."
Angel looked at Muddy's knife. It was a bone-handled jackknife, and part of the bone was chipped. It was one of those jackknives where the blade locks in place when you open it so it can't close on your fingers. The blade was almost 6 inches long, which would make it very prominent in anyone's pocket, and over the years it had seen a lot of whetstone. The blade was ground down very thin, and the edge was very sharp.
"Don't you need it, Muddy?" Angel asked him.
"I never knew what to do with it," Muddy confessed. "I just get in trouble with it."
"I'll give it to her," Angel said.
"You tell her her father say he'd love her, he'd just want to see her," Muddy said.
"Just see," he repeated.
Angel considered this message. Then he said,
"I love Rose, you know, Muddy."
"Sure I know," Muddy said. "I love her, too. We all love her. Everybody love Rose. That's part of the problem."
"If Mr. Rose just wants to see her," Angel said, "how come you're giving her your knife?"
"Just so she have one," Muddy repeated.
Angel gave her the knife when they were sitting in his room after supper.
"It's from Muddy," he told her.
"I know who it's from," Rose said.
"I know what knife everyone got. I know what they all look like."
Although it was not a switchblade, it made Angel jump to see how quickly she opened the knife using only one hand.
"Look what Muddy do," she said, laughing. "He been sharpening it to death. He wore it half away."
She closed the knife against her hip. Her long fingers moved the knife around so quickly that Angel didn't notice where she put it.
"You know a lot about knives?" Angel asked her.
"From my father," she said. "He show me everything."
Angel moved and sat on the bed next to her. But
Rose regarded him neutrally. "I told you," she began patiently, "you don't want to have no business with me. I could never tell you nothing about me. You don't want to know about me, believe me."
"But I love you," Angel pleaded with her.
After she kissed him, and she allowed him to touch her breasts, she said,
"Angel, loving someone don't always make no difference."
Then baby Rose woke up, and Rose had to attend to her daughter.
"You know what I'm naming her?" she asked Angel.
"Candy," Rose said. "That's who she is. She a candy."
In the morning, on the downhill side of the harvest, everyone got up early, but no one got up earlier than Rose. Angel, who had more or less been imagining that he was guarding the house all night, noticed that Rose and her daughter had gone. Angel and Homer got in the jeep and drove out to the cider house before breakfast, but there was nowhere they could go that morning that Rose hadn't been to ahead of them. The men were up and looking restless, and Mr. Rose was already maintaining his stoical sitting position in the grass in front of the cider house, the blanket completely covering him, except for his face.
"You too late," Mr. Rose said to them. "She long gone."
Angel ran and looked in the cider house, but there was no sign of Rose or her daughter.
"She gone with her thumb, she say," Mr. Rose told Homer and Angel.
He made the hitchhiking sign, his bare hand emerging from the blanket only for a second before it went back into hiding.
"I didn't hurt her," Mr. Rose went on. I didn't touch her, Homer, he said. I just love her, was all. I just want to see her. One more time.
I'm sorry for your troubles, Homer Wells told the man, but Angel ran off to find Muddy.
She say to tell you you was the nicest, Muddy told the boy. She say to tell your dad he a hero, and that you was the nicest.
She didn't say where she was going?
She don't know where she going, Angel, Muddy told him. She just knows she gotta go.
But she could have stayed with us, Angel said. With me, he added.
I know she thought about it, Muddy said. You better think about it, too.
I have thought about it. I think about it all the time, Angel said angrily.
I don't think you old enough to think about it, Angel, Muddy said gently.
I loved her, the boy said.
She know, Muddy said. She know who she is, too, but she also know you don't know who you is yet.
Looking for her and thinking about her would help Angel to know that. He and Candy would drive south along the coast for an hour. Then they would drive north for two. They knew that even Rose Rose would know enough about Maine not to go inland. And they knew that a young black woman with a baby in her arms would be quite exotic among the hitchhikers of Maine. She certainly would have less trouble than Melanie getting a ride, and Melanie always got rides.
Mr. Rose would maintain his almost Buddhist position. He made it through lunch without moving, but in the afternoon he asked Black Pan to bring him some water, and when the men were through picking that day, he called Muddy over to him. Muddy was very frightened, but he approached Mr. Rose and stood at a distance of about 6 feet from him.
"Where your knife, Muddy?" Mr. Rose asked him. "You lose it?"
"I didn't lose it," Muddy told him.
"But I can't find it," he added.
"It around, you mean?" Mr. Rose asked him.
"It around somewhere, but you don't know where."
"I don't know where it is," Muddy admitted.
"Never do you no good anyway, do it?" Mr. Rose asked him.
"I never could use it," Muddy admitted. It was a cold and sunless late afternoon, but Muddy was sweating. He held his hands at his sides as if his hands were dead fish.
"Where she get the knife, Muddy?" Mr. Rose asked.
"What knife?" Muddy asked him.
"It looked like your knife, what I seen of it," said Mr. Rose.
"I gave it to her," Muddy admitted.
"Thank you for doing that, Muddy," Mr. Rose said. "If she'd gone with her thumb, I'm glad she got a knife with her."
"Peaches!" Muddy screamed. "Go get Homer!"
Peaches came out of the cider house and stared at Mr. Rose, who didn't move a muscle. Mr. Rose didn't look at Peaches at all.
"Black Pan!"
Muddy screamed, as Peaches went running off to get Homer Wells. Black Pan came out of the cider house, and he and Muddy got down on their knees and peered at Mr. Rose together.
"You all stay calm," Mr. Rose advised them.
"You too late," he told them. "No one gonna catch her now. She had all day to get away," Mr. Rose said proudly.
"Where she get you?" Muddy asked Mr. Rose, but neither he nor Black Pan dared to poke around under the blanket. They just watched Mr. Rose's eyes and his dry lips.
"She good with that knife. She better with it than you ever be," Mr. Rose said to Muddy.
"I know she good," Muddy said.
"She almost the best," said Mr. Rose.
"And who taught her?" he asked them.
"You did," they told him.
"That's right," said Mr. Rose. "That why she almost as good as me."
Very slowly, without exposing any of himself, keeping himself completely under the blanket except for his face, Mr. Rose rolled over on his side and tucked his knees up to his chest.
"I'm real tired of sitting up," he told Muddy and Black Pan.
"I'm getting sleepy."
"Where she get you?" Muddy asked him again.
"I didn't think it would take this long," said Mr. Rose.
It taken all day, but it feel like it was going to go pretty fast.
All the men were standing around him when Homer Wells and Peaches arrived in the jeep. Mr. Rose had very little left to say when Homer got to him.
"You breaking them rules, too, Homer?" Mr. Rose whispered to him. "Say, you know how I feel."
"I know how you feel," said Homer Wells.
"Right," said Mr. Rose, grinning.
The knife had entered in the upper right quadrant, close to the rib margin. Homer knew that a knife moving in an upward direction would give a substantial liver laceration, which would continue to bleed at a moderate rate for many hours. Mr. Rose might have stopped bleeding several times and started again. In most cases, a liver stab wound hemorrhages very slowly. Mr. Rose died in Homer's arms before Candy and Angel arrived at the cider house, but long after his daughter had made good her escape. Mr. Rose had managed to soak the blade of his own knife in his wound, and the last thing he told Homer was that it should be clear to the authorities that he had stabbed himself. If he hadn't meant to kill himself, why would he have let himself bleed to death from what wasn't necessarily a mortal wound?
"My daughter run away," Mr. Rose told all of them. "And I'm so sorry that I stuck myself." "You better say that what happened." "Let me hear you say it," he raised his voice to them.
"That what happened," Muddy said.
"You kill yourself," Peaches told him.
"That what happened," Black Pan said.
"You hearing this right, Homer?"
Mr. Rose asked him. That was how Homer reported it. That was how the death of Mr. Rose was received, the way he wanted it, according to the cider house rules. Rose Rose had broken the rules, of course, but everyone at Ocean View knew the rules Mr. Rose had broken with her. At the end of the harvest, on a gray morning with a wild wind blowing in from the ocean, the overhead bulb that hung in the cider house kitchen blinked twice and burned out. The spatter of apple mash on the far wall, near the press and grinder, was cast so somberly in shadows that the dark clots of pumice looked like black leaves that had blown indoors and stuck against the wall in a storm. The men were picking up their few things. Homer Wells was there, with the bonus checks, and Angel had come with him to say goodbye to Muddy and Peaches and Black Pan and the rest of them. Wally had made some arrangements with Black Pan to be crew boss the next year. Wally had been right about Mr. Rose being the only one of them who could read well and write at all. Muddy told Angel that he'd always thought the list of rules tacked to the kitchen wall was something to do with the building's electricity.
"'Cause it was always near the light switch," Muddy explained. "I thought there was instructions about the lights."
The other men, since they couldn't read at all, never noticed that the list was there.
"Muddy, if you should happen to see her," Angel said when he was saying goodbye.
"I won't see her, Angel," Muddy told the boy. "She long gone."
Then they were all long gone. Angel would never see Muddy again, either, or Peaches, or any of the rest of them except Black Pan. It wouldn't work out, having Black Pan as a crew boss, as Wally would discover. The man was a cook, not a picker, and the boss had to be in the field with the men. Although Black Pan would gather a fair picking crew together, he was never quite in charge of them. In future years, of course, no one would ever be as in charge of a picking crew at Ocean View as Mr. Rose had been. For a while, Wally would try hiring French Canadians. They were, after all, closer to Maine than the Carolinas. But the French Canadian crews were often ill-tempered and alcoholic, and Wally would always be trying to get the French Canadians out of jail. One year, Wally would hire a commune, but that crew arrived with too many small children. The pregnant women on the ladders made everyone nervous. They left something cooking all day and started a small fire in the kitchen. And when the men ran the press, they allowed their children to splash about in the vat. Wally would finally settle on Jamaicans. They were friendly, nonviolent, and good workers. They brought with them an interesting music and a straightforward but contained passion for beer and for a little marijuana.
They knew how to handle the fruit, and they never hurt each other. But after Mr. Rose's last summer at Ocean View, the pickers, whoever they were, would never sit on the cider house roof. It just never occurred to them. And no one would ever put up a list of rules again. In future years, the only person who ever sat on the cider house roof was Angel Wells, who would do it because he liked that particular view of the ocean, and because he wanted to remember that November day in 1950-something, after Muddy and the rest of them had left, and his father turned to him, they were alone at the cider house, and said, "How about sitting on the roof for a while with me? It's time you knew the whole story." "Another little story?" Angel asked. "I said the whole story," said Homer Wells. And although it was a cold day that November, and the wind off the sea was briny and raw, father and son sat on that roof a long time. It was, after all, a long story, and Angel would ask a lot of questions. Candy, who drove by the cider house and saw them sitting up there, was worried about how cold they must be. But she didn't interrupt them. She just kept driving. She hoped the truth would keep them warm. She drove to the barn nearest the apple mart and got Everett Taft to help her put the canvas canopy on the Jeep. Then she went and got Wally out of the office. "Where are we going?" Wally asked her. She bundled him up in a blanket as if she were taking him to the Arctic Circle. "We must be going north," he said when she didn't answer him. "My father's dock," she told him. Wally knew that Ray Kendall's dock and everything else belonging to Ray had been blown over land and sea. He kept quiet. The ugly little car hop restaurant that Bucky Bean had manufactured was closed for the season. They were alone. Candy drove the Jeep through the empty parking lot and out to a rocky embankment that served as a seawall against the waves in Hartshaven Harbor. She stopped as near to the ocean's edge as she dared to, near the old pilings of what had been her father's dock, where she and Wally had spent so many evenings so long ago. Then, since this wasn't wheelchair terrain, she carried Wally about 10 yards over the rocks and the sand, and sat him down on a relatively smooth and flat shelf of the jagged coastline. She wrapped Wally's legs in the blanket, and then she sat down behind him and straddled him with her legs, as a way of keeping them both warm. They sat facing Europe in this position, like riders on a sled about to plunge downhill. "This is fun," Wally said. She stuck her chin over his shoulder. Their cheeks were touching. She hugged him around his arms and his chest, and she squeezed his withered hips with her legs. "I love you, Wally," Candy said, beginning her story. In late November, in the mousing season, the Board of Trustees at St. Cloud's approved the appointment of Dr. F. Stone as obstetrician-in-residence and the new director of the orphanage, having met the zealous missionary in the board's chambers in Portland, the birthplace of the late Wilbur Larch. Dr. Stone, who appeared a little tired from his Asian journey and from what he described as a touch of something dysenteric, made the correct impression on the board. His manner was somber, his hair was graying and cropped in an almost military fashion. "Hindu barbers," he apologized, showing a mild sense of humor. Actually, Candy had cut his hair. Homer Wells was carelessly shaven, clean but tousled in his dress, both at ease and impatient with strangers, in the manner, the board thought, of a man with urgent business who was not in the least vain about his appearance. He hadn't the time. The board also approved of Dr. Stone's medical and religious credentials. The latter, in the estimation of the devout Mrs. Goodhall, would give to Dr. Stone's authority in St. Cloud's a balance that she noted had been missing in Dr. Larch. Dr. Gingrich was excited to note the contortions registered on Mrs. Goodhall's face during the entire meeting with young Dr. Stone, who did not recognize Gingrich and Goodhall from his brief glimpse of them in the off-season Algonquin Hotel. Dr. Gingrich found a comforting familiarity in the young man's face,
although he would never associate the glow of a missionary with the sorrowful longing he had seen in the face of the lover. Perhaps Mrs. Goodhall's tick affected her vision. She did not recognize the young man from the hotel either, or else her mind would never grasp the possibility that a man devoted to children could also be a man with a practicing sexual life. To Homer Wells, Mrs. Goodhall and Dr. Gingrich were not special enough to remember. The peevish miseries compounded in their expressions were not unique. And the way that Homer looked when he was with Candy was not the way he looked most of the time. On the matter of abortions, Dr. Stone surprised the board by the adamant conviction he held, that they should be legalized, and that he intended to work through the proper channels toward that end. However, Dr. Stone assured them, as long as abortions were illegal, he would rigorously uphold the law. He believed in rules, and in obeying them, he told the board. They liked the hardship and self-sacrifice that they imagined they could witness in the wrinkles around his dark eyes, and how the fierce Asian sun had blistered his nose and cheeks while he had toiled to save the diuretic children. Actually, he had deliberately sat for too long in front of Candy's sun lamp. And, on the religious grounds more comfortable to the board, and to Mrs. Goodhall especially, Dr. Stone said that he himself never would perform abortions, even if they were legalized. "I just couldn't do it," he lied calmly. If it ever was legal, of course, he would simply refer the unfortunate woman to one of those doctors who could and would. It was clear that Dr. Stone found those doctors not to his liking, that despite his loyalty to Dr. Larch, Dr. Stone found that particular practice of Larch's to be an act decidedly against nature. It was in large measure indicative of Dr. Stone's Christian tolerance that despite his long-standing disagreement with Dr. Larch on this delicate subject, the young missionary was forgiving of Larch, far more forgiving than the board by no small portion. "I always prayed for him," Dr. Stone said of Dr. Larch, his eyes shining. "I still pray for him." It was an emotional moment, perhaps influenced by the aforementioned touch of something dysenteric. The board was predictably moved by it. Mrs. Goodhall's tick went wild. On the matter of Nurse Caroline's socialist views, Dr. Stone assured the board that the young woman's fervor to do the right thing had simply been, in her youth, misguided. He would tell her a few things about the communist guerrilla activity in Burma that would open her eyes. And Dr. Stone convinced the board that the older nurses and Mrs. Grogan had a few more years of good service in them. "It's all a matter of guidance," Dr. Stone told the board. Now, there was a word that pleased Dr. Gingrich. Dr. Stone opened his hands. They were rather roughly calloused for the hands of a doctor, Mrs. Goodhall would observe, thinking it charming how this healer of children must have helped with building the huts or planting the gardens or whatever other rough work there had been to do over there. When he said guidance, Homer Wells opened his hands the way a minister received a congregation, thought the board, or the way a good doctor received the precious head of a newborn child, they thought. And it was thrilling, after they had interviewed him, how he blessed them as he was leaving them, and how he salaamed to them. "Na sakin," said the missionary doctor. "Oh, what had he said?" they all wanted to know. Wally, of course, had taught Homer the correct pronunciation, it being one of the few Burmese things that Wally had ever heard correctly, although he'd never learned what it meant. Homer Wells translated the phrase for them. Wally had always thought it was someone's name. "It means," Homer told the enraptured board, "may God watch over your soul, which no man may abuse." There were loud murmurs of approval. Mrs. Goodhall said, "All that in such a short phrase." "It's a remarkable language," Dr. Stone told them dreamily. "Na sakin," he told them again. He got them all to repeat it after him. He was pleased to imagine them later giving this meaningless blessing to each other. It would have pleased him more if he'd ever known what the phrase actually meant. It was the perfect thing for a board of trustees to go around saying to each other. "Curried fish balls." "I think I got away with it," Homer told Wally and Candy and Angel when they were eating a late supper in the house at Ocean View.
"It doesn't surprise me," Wally told his friend. "I have every reason to believe that you can get away with anything."
Upstairs, after supper, Angel watched his father pack the old black doctor's bag, and some other bags as well.
"Don't worry, Pop," Angel told his father. "You're going to do just fine."
"You're going to do just fine, too," Homer told his son. "I'm not worried about that."
Downstairs, they heard Candy pushing Wally around in the wheelchair. They were playing the game that Wally and Angel often played, the game Wally called flying.
"Come on," Wally was saying. "Angel can make it go faster."
Candy was laughing.
"I'm going as fast as I can," Candy said.
"Please stop thinking about the furniture," Wally told her.
"Please look after Wally," Homer said to Angel. "Mind your mother," he told his son.
"Right," said Angel Wells.
In the constantly changing weather of Maine, especially on cloudy days, the presence of St. Clouds could be felt in Hart's Rock. With a heavy certainty, the air of St. Clouds could be distinguished in the trapped stillness that hovered above the water of Drinkwater Lake, like those water bugs, those water walkers that were nearly constant there. And even in the fog that rolled over those bright coastal lawns of Hart's Haven's well-to-do, there was sometimes in the storm-coming air that leaden, heart-sinking feeling that was the essence of the air of St. Clouds. Candy and Wally and Angel would go to St. Clouds for Christmas, and for the longer of Angel's school vacations, too. And after Angel had his driver's license, he was free to visit his father as often as he liked, which was often. But when Homer Wells went to St. Clouds, even though Wally had offered him a car, Homer took the train. Homer knew he wouldn't need a car there, and he wanted to arrive the way most of his patients did. He wanted to get the feel of it. In late November, there was already snow as the train moved north and inland, and by the time the train reached St. Clouds, the blue cold snow was deeply on the ground and heavily bent the trees. The station master, who hated to leave the television, was shoveling snow off the platform when the train pulled in. The station master thought he recognized Homer Wells, but the stern black doctor's bag and the new beard fooled him. Homer had started the beard because it had hurt to shave, after he'd burned his face with the sun lamp. And once the beard had grown for a while, he thought the change would be suitable. Didn't a beard go with his new name? "Dr. Stone," Homer said to the station master, introducing himself. "Fuzzy Stone," he said. "I used to be an orphan here. Now I'm the new doctor."
"Oh, I thought you was familiar," the station master said, bowing as he shook Homer's hand.
Only one other passenger had gotten off the train in St. Clouds, and Homer Wells had no difficulty imagining what she wanted. She was a thin young woman in a long muskrat coat with a scarf and a ski hat pulled almost over her eyes, and she hung back on the platform, waiting for Homer to move away from the station master. It was the doctor's bag that had caught her attention, and after Homer had arranged for the usual louts to tote his heavier luggage, he started up the hill to the orphanage, carrying just the doctor's bag. The young woman followed him. They walked uphill in this fashion, with the woman lagging purposefully behind, until they almost reached the girls' division. Then Homer stopped walking and waited for her.
"Is this the way to the orphanage?" the young woman asked him.
"Right," said Homer Wells. Since he had grown the beard, he tended to over-smile at people. He imagined that the beard made it hard for people to tell whether he was smiling. "Are you the doctor?" the young woman asked him, staring at the snow on both their boots, and warily at the doctor's bag.
"Yes, I'm Dr. Stone," he said, taking the woman's arm and leading her toward the hospital entrance of the boys' division.
"May I help you?" he asked her.
And so he arrived, as Nurse Edna would say, bringing the Lord's work with him. Nurse Angela threw her arms around his neck and whispered in his ear, "Oh, Homer," she whispered, "I knew you'd be back."
"Call me Fuzzy," he whispered to her,
because he knew that Homer Wells, like Rose Rose, was long gone. For several days, Nurse Caroline would be shy with him, but he wouldn't need more than a few operations and a few deliveries to convince her that he was the real thing. Dr. Stone, even as a name, would be a fitting successor to Dr. Larch. For wasn't Stone a good, hard, feet-on-the-ground, reliable-sounding sort of name for a physician? Mrs. Grogan would remark that she had not enjoyed being read aloud to so much since those hard-to-remember days of Homer Wells. And it was to everyone's relief that Fuzzy Stone would exhibit as few symptoms of his former respiratory difficulties as Homer Wells had exhibited signs of a weak and damaged heart. Candy and Wally Worthington would throw themselves full tilt into apple farming. Wally would serve 2 terms as president of the Maine Horticultural Society. Candy would serve a term as director of the New York New England Apple Institute. And Angel Wells, whom Rose Rose had introduced to love and to imagination, would one day be a novelist. "The kid's got fiction in his blood," Wally would tell Homer Wells. To Candy, a novelist was also what Homer Wells had become. For a novelist, in Candy's opinion, was also a kind of impostor doctor, but a good doctor nonetheless. Homer never minded giving up his name. It wasn't his actual name to begin with. And it was as easy to be a Fuzzy as it was to be a Homer. As easy or as hard to be a Stone as it was to be anything else. When he was tired or plagued with insomnia, or both, he would miss Angel, or he would think of Candy. Sometimes he longed to carry Wally into the surf, or to fly with him. Some nights Homer imagined he would be caught, or he worried about what he would do when Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna were too old for the Lord's work, and for all the other work in St. Cloud's. And how would he ever replace Mrs. Grogan? Sometimes, when he was especially tired, he dreamed that abortions were legal, that they were safe and available, and therefore he could stop performing them, because someone else would do them. But he was rarely that tired. And after a while he would write to Candy and say that he had become a socialist, or at least that he'd become sympathetic to socialist views. Candy understood by this confession that Homer was sleeping with Nurse Caroline, which she also understood would be good for them. That is, this new development was good for Homer and for Nurse Caroline, and it was good for Candy, too. Homer Wells saw no end to the insights he perceived nightly in his continuous reading from Jane Eyre and from David Copperfield and Great Expectations. He would smile to remember how he had once thought Dickens was better than Bronte. When they both gave such huge entertainment and instruction, what did it matter, he thought. And from where comes this childish business of better? If not entertainment, he took continued instruction from Gray's Anatomy. For a while, he lacked one thing, and he was about to order it when one came unordered to him. "As if from God," Mrs. Grogan would say. The station master sent him the message. There was a body at the railroad station addressed to Dr. Stone. It was from the hospital in Bath, which had been Dr. Larch's long-standing source for bodies in the days when he'd ordered them. It was some mistake, Homer Wells was sure, but he went to the railroad station to view the body anyway, and to spare the station master any unnecessary agitation. Homer stood staring at the cadaver, which had been correctly prepared, for such a long time that the station master grew even more anxious. "I'd just as soon you either take it up the hill or send it back," the station master said. But Homer Wells waved the fool off. He wanted peace to look at Melanie. She had requested this use of her body, Lorna had told the pathologist at the Bath Hospital. Melanie had seen a photograph in the Bath paper, together with an article revealing Dr. Stone's appointment in St. Cloud's. In the event of her death, which was caused by an electrical accident, Melanie had instructed Lorna to send her body to Dr. Stone in St. Cloud's. "I might be of some use to him, finally," she had told her friend. Of course, Homer remembered how Melanie had been jealous of Clara. He would write to Lorna. They would correspond for a while. Lorna would inform him that Melanie was a relatively happy woman at the time of her accident. In Lorna's opinion, something to do with how relaxed Melanie had become was responsible for her electrocuting herself. She was a daydreamer, Lorna would write. Homer knew that all orphans were daydreamers. You was her hero, finally, Lorna would tell him. When he viewed her body, he knew he could never use it for a refresher course. He would send to Bath for another cadaver. Melanie had been used enough.
"Should I send it back, Doctor?" the station master whispered.
"No, she belongs here," Homer Wells told him. And so he had Melanie brought uphill. It would be essential to keep the sight of her in her present form a secret from Mrs. Grogan. What Homer told them all was that Melanie had requested she be buried in St. Cloud's. And so she was. On the hill, under the apple trees, where it was tortuously hard to dig a correct hole, the root systems of the trees were everywhere. Finally, a large and deep enough hole was managed, although it was back-breaking labor, and Nurse Caroline said, "I don't know who she is, but she sure is difficult."
"She was always that," said Homer Wells.
"Here in St. Cloud's," Wilbur Larch had written, "we learn to love the difficult." Mrs. Grogan said her Cardinal Newman over Melanie's grave, and Homer said his own prayer to himself about her. He had always expected much from Melanie, but she had provided him with more than he'd ever expected. She had truly educated him. She had shown him the light. She was more sunshine than he ever was, he thought. "Let us be happy for Melanie," he said to himself. "Melanie has found a family." But chiefly for his education he would peruse and linger over every word of A Brief History of St. Cloud's. In this pursuit he would have Nurse Angela's and Nurse Edna's and Mrs. Grogan's and Nurse Caroline's tireless company, for by this pursuit they would keep Wilbur Larch alive. Not that everything was clear to Homer. The later entries in A Brief History of St. Cloud's were marred by shorthand inspirations and the whimsy conveyed to Larch through ether. For example, what did Larch mean by rhymes with screams? And it seemed uncharacteristically harsh of Larch to have written, "I put the pony's penis in her mouth. I contributed to that." How could he have thought that? Homer wondered. Because Homer never knew how well Dr. Larch had known Mrs. Eames's daughter. And as he grew older, Homer Wells, alias Fuzzy Stone, would take special comfort in an unexplained revelation he found in the writings of Wilbur Larch. "Tell Dr. Stone," Dr. Larch wrote, and this was his very last entry. These were Wilbur Larch's last words. "There is absolutely nothing wrong with Homer's heart." Except for the ether, Homer Wells knew that there had been very little that was wrong with the heart of Wilbur Larch. To Nurse Edna, who was in love, and to Nurse Angela, who wasn't, but who had in her wisdom named both Homer Wells and Fuzzy Stone, there was no fault to be found in the hearts of either Dr. Stone or Dr. Larch, who were, if there ever were, princes of Maine, kings of New England. Author's Notes. Page 47. Wilbur Larch's father, quote, "shook his head a lot and all his life dispensed this misinformation, that the 19,000-ton ship the Great Eastern, which was built in Portland, was destined to sail the North Atlantic between Europe and Maine," end quote. Anthony Trollope, who visited Portland, Maine in 1861 and wrote about it in his North America, was mistaken, in the manner of Wilbur Larch's father, about the intended future of the Great Eastern. Page 51. Quote, "The demonstrator of bacteriology at Harvard Medical School, a Dr. Harold Ernst, is best remembered as one of the first college baseball pitchers to throw a curveball. He was also the first college baseball player to become a bacteriologist," end quote. I am indebted to my grandfather, Dr. Frederick C. Irving, for this information regarding Dr. Ernst, the curveball pitcher, and for the particularly medical language in this chapter. My grandfather's books include The Expectant Mother's Handbook, A Textbook of Obstetrics, and Safe Deliverance. Dr. Ernst's studies of bacterial infections drew the attention of a Dr. Richardson of the Boston Lying-In Hospital, the maternity hospital where Wilbur Larch served an internship and later joined the staff. Dr. Richardson's article, The Use of Antiseptics in Obstetric Practice, would surely have caught the attention of that eager student of bacteriology, collapse sufferer Wilbur Larch. The interest in antiseptics among obstetricians was due to their effect in preventing the most deadly puerperal infection of that day, childbed fever. In 1880-something, in some maternity hospitals, the death rate among the mothers was about 1 in 8. In 1890-something, when Wilbur Larch was still at the Boston lying-in, a mother's odds were better. The doctors and their patients were washed with a solution of bichloride of mercury. Before Larch would leave the Boston lying-in, he would see the antiseptic technique advanced to the aseptic, the latter meaning free from bacteria, which meant that everything was sterilized, the sheets, the towels, the gowns, the gauze sponges. The instruments were boiled. Pages 51 to 52. On the use of ether. Most historians of anesthesia agree with Dr. Sherwin B. Newland that surgical anesthesia began at Massachusetts General Hospital on October 16, 1846, when William Morton demonstrated the effectiveness of ether. Dr. Newland writes, "Everything that led up to it was prologue, everything that was tangential to it was byplay, and everything that followed it was amplification." According to Dr. Newland, ether in proper hands remains one of the safest inhalation agents known. At a concentration of only 1 to 2%, it is a light, tasty vapor. In light concentration, even 30 years ago, hundreds of cases of cardiac surgery were done with light ether and partially awake, even talking, patients. Some of Dr. Larch's colleagues at the time would have preferred nitrous oxide or chloroform, but Larch developed his preference for ether through self-administration. Someone would be crazy to self-administer chloroform. It's 25 times more toxic to heart muscle than is ether, and has an extremely narrow margin of safety. A minimal overdose can result in cardiac irregularity and death. Nitrous oxide requires a very high, at least 80% concentration to do the job, and is always accompanied by a degree of what is called hypoxia, insufficient oxygen. It requires careful monitoring and cumbersome apparatus, and the patient runs the risk of bizarre fantasies or giggling fits. Induction is very fast. Ether is a perfect drug addiction for a conservative. Page 53, referring to Wilbur Larch's delivery of the Lithuanian baby. The source of this story is again my grandfather, who graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1910. He became chief of staff of the Boston Lying-in Hospital and was William Lambert Richardson, professor of obstetrics at Harvard for a number of years. I remember him as a good storyteller and an occasional bully of the other members of his family. As a young doctor, he had many experiences delivering babies to Boston's poorer immigrant families, and to read him is to understand that he had as many opinions and prejudices as he had experiences and talents. Page 54, regarding Wilbur Larch's ether addiction. Ether was first synthesized in 1540 by a 25-year-old Prussian botanist. People have been having ether frolics and later laughing gas parties ever since. In 1819, John Dalton published his study of the compound's physical and chemical properties. Coleridge was a laughing-gas man, a party sniffer, and a frequenter of the experiments with nitrous oxide conducted by Humphrey Davy. The poet was certainly familiar with ether. It was a pity for him that he apparently preferred opium. Page 55. A cesarean section is today a relatively calm operation. The abdominal incision is small because the uterus is opened inside the abdominal cavity. But in Dr. Larch's days at the Boston Lying-In, in 1880 and 1890-something, the incision made in the abdominal wall was nearly a foot long. The uterus was lifted through the incision and placed upon the patient's abdomen. "The slashing of this great plum-colored organ produced a dramatic gush of liquid and blood," my grandfather wrote. The uterus was then sutured with silk and returned to the abdominal cavity. The abdomen was closed in the same way. Considerably more discomfort followed such an operation than follows a cesarean section now. The operation in Larch's time, and without complications, would require nearly an hour. Page 58. Quote, "The French lunar solution Mrs. Eames had tried was oil of tansy. She had taken it for such a long time and in such amounts that her intestines had lost their ability to absorb vitamin C." End quote. This death by scurvy is based on an actual case. The strange case of Ellen Bean, as told by my grandfather. "A spinster of 35 years and of New England stock," grandfather wrote of Miss Bean, whose condition and cause of death was the same fate I awarded to the unfortunate Mrs. Eames. As my grandfather wrote, "The pregnant state does not engender in all women the rapturous joy traditionally associated with this condition. Indeed, there are some who view their future with a sour visage and a jaundiced eye. This much may be assumed from the case of Ellen Bean." Page 58. In Wilbur Larch's own state, in dear old Maine, performing an abortion was punishable by a year in jail, or a $1,000 fine, or both. And, if you were a doctor, you might lose your license to practice. The Eastman Everett Act of 1840 described the attempted abortion of any woman with child as an offense, whether such child be quick or not, and regardless of the method. Page 59. Instead of red methylate, Dr. Larch might have used Dakin's solution, although it's likely he would have learned more about its uses during his short visit to France in World War I. That is where my grandfather learned of the many uses of Dakin's solution, and where he learned how to debride. That is, to cut away all the devitalized tissue surrounding a wound. The French were good teachers of this, he said. Page 68, referring to Wilbur Larch's first abortion, quote, "This is a 13-year-old girl. Her pelvis is only 3.5 inches in diameter. Two previous violent deliveries have lacerated her soft parts and left her with a mass of unyielding scar tissue." End of quote. This is my grandfather's description of the condition of an actual patient, an extremely small woman named Edith Fletcher, upon whom a cesarean section was performed, Boston lying in hospital, July 13, 1894. A pelvis this small is rare. Pages 68 to 69. Mrs. W. H. Maxwell's A Female Physician to the Ladies of the United States, being a familiar and practical treatise of matters of utmost importance peculiar to women, adapted to every woman's own private use, was published in New York in 1860. Mrs. Maxwell treated all diseases peculiar to women, or which they may have unfortunately incurred through the dissipations or wanton unfaithfulness of their husbands or otherwise. In short, she treated venereal diseases. Mrs. Maxwell also wrote that she gave her attention as well to women who are forced by the malfunction of their genital organs or other cause to resort to premature delivery. In short, she performed abortions. Pages 101 to 102. The New England Home for Little Wanderers was originally the Baldwin Place Home for Little Wanderers. The charter was granted by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in 1865. The name was changed to the New England Home for Little Wanderers, its present name, in 1889, more than a decade before Wilbur Larch founded the orphanage in St. Cloud's. Page 111. In a 1928 gynecology textbook, Howard Kelly, the standard at that time, the term D&C is used. I think it's safe to assume that the term was in common use in 1920-something. Page 111. My grandfather said that he needed to use his Gray's Anatomy in France in World War I as a navigational chart. Pages 119 to 120, referring to Homer Wells's notes on D&C. This is an exact description of a D&C as viewed by Dr. Richard Seltzer, Yale School of Medicine, a general surgeon and author, Mortal Lessons, Notes on the Art of Surgery, and Rituals of Surgery, are among his books. I'm grateful for his reading of the manuscript of this novel and his generous advice, especially his introducing me to Dr. Newland, who was the overseer of all the medical aspects of this novel. Page 127, in reference to Senior Worthington. The source of my information concerning the physical and mental manifestations of Alzheimer's disease is the Journal of the History of Medicine and Allied Sciences, Volume 34, Number 3, July 1979. The article by Dr. Sherwin B. Newland, The Enigma of Semmelweis, an Interpretation. Dr. Newland first presented his material in a lecture at the Yale School of Medicine, the Annual History of Surgery series. His thesis is that Ignaz Semmelweis, the tortured discoverer of the sources of puerperal fever, suffered from Alzheimer's disease and not from neurosyphilis. Furthermore, Dr. Newland believes that Semmelweis died of injuries received in a mental institution, i.e., he was beaten to death by his keepers. The records of Bedlam and of other institutions for the insane show that this was common as late as the early part of this century, and occasional reports still appear. Pages 131 to 132. The source of the description of Homer Wells's first eclampsia patient is my grandfather's book, Safe Deliverance, the chapter on puerperal convulsions. Grandfather examines the case of a Lucy Nickerson, who died in 1880 of an eclamptic condition that was further aggravated by a forced delivery, the only method known to physicians of the unfortunate Mrs. Nickerson's day. The source of the treatment is again my grandfather, Dr. Frederick C. Irving. He was called Fritz. Grandfather describes this as the correct and life-saving treatment given to one Mrs. Mary O'Toole in 1937. Page 137. As of 1942, these are my grandfather's findings. Syphilis, although a great source of agitation to the public health officials of the day, afflicted only 2% of the pregnant women of Boston. the incidence of eclamptic convulsions was much higher. The disease developed in 8% of the country's childbearing women. Page 154. Spring would be considered too early to bother waxing the press boards. The first press wouldn't be until September, when you'd be pressing the early Macintoshes and the Gravensteins. The press boards or racks are wooden slats over which the cider cloths or press cloths are folded. The press boards, they are stacked 7 high, take quite a beating, and the wax protects them. The mash, which is also called the pumice, is squeezed between these boards under a pressure of 2,000 pounds. It takes 8 hours to squeeze 1,000 gallons of cider out of the press, about 3 gallons per bushel of apples. The reason you wax the press boards before the first press is that you don't want to take the time to do it once the harvest has begun. And you're running the cider mill during the harvest maybe as much as every other night, and every day that it rains, when you can't pick apples. In the 1940s and 1950s, the last good press would have come in January. I'm indebted to my old friends Ben and Peter Wagner and to their mother Jean for this and other apple farming information. The Wagners run the Applecrest Farm Orchards in Hampton Falls, New Hampshire, where I worked when I was a boy. Jean and her late husband Bill gave me my first job. All orchards have names. It's common practice, too, for farmers to name their buildings. This is necessary for the shorthand language of simple directions, as in, the deer has a flat and needs fixing in the frying pan, or, I left the Dodge in number 2 because Wally is spraying in the Sanborn and he'll need a ride back. In the orchard where I worked, there was a building called number 2, although there was no number 3, and I don't remember a number 1. Many of the orchards were named after the families who'd been the original homesteaders on that particular piece of land. Brown, Eaton, Coburn, and Curtis are some local names I remember. There was an orchard called 20 Acres and another one called 19, and there were the plainer names. An orchard called the Field, one called the Fountain, one called the Spring, and one called Old New, because it was half old trees and half newly planted. The Frying Pan is also called Frying Pan, without the article. Page 162, quote, "It's a wind coming from the coast," Wilbur Larch said. "He sniffed deeply for traces of salt," end of quote. Anyone who grew up near the ocean, as I did, could detect a sea breeze in Iowa if one was blowing. Page 215. The prayer that Mrs. Grogan recites is credited to John Henry Cardinal Newman, the English theologian and author, 1801 to 1890. I'm told that the prayer was originally part of one of Cardinal Newman's sermons. It was also what served my family as a family prayer and was spoken at the graveside of my maternal grandmother. It was her favorite. Her name was Helen Bates Winslow, and she died just a month short of her 100th birthday. The festivities the family had planned for that event would doubtlessly have killed my grandmother had she lived until then. Cardinal Newman's prayer must be a very good one, or at least it worked very well, and for a long time, for my grandmother, who was devoted to it. I was devoted to her. Page 231. Alzheimer described the disease he called presenile dementia in 1907. Deterioration in cognition occurs relatively early in the disease and is marked by a disturbance of recent memory and a loss of the ability to learn new things. Dr. Newland of Yale also states that some patients are more likely to begin with personality changes and some with intellectual changes. The advance of the disease in either case is marked by a lowering threshold of frustration. Dr. Newland notes that the sequence in which certain small jobs need to be done would be difficult to follow and that complex ideas are hard to comprehend and impossible to explain to others. It is a rapid deterioration that advances in Alzheimer victims. The average lifespan from the time of diagnosis is approximately 7 years. There are patients who live much longer and many who die within a few months. In recent years, it has been recognized that Alzheimer's is not only an uncommon disease that affects people in midlife, but also a relatively frequent cause of mental and physical degeneration in the elderly, many of whom were previously thought to have simple hardening of the arteries, arteriosclerosis. Page 278, referring to Senior Worthington's favorite limerick beginning "O Pity the Duchess of Kent." The famous Paris edition of 1957, which was privately printed, collected 1,700 examples of the limerick. This limerick, which is categorized as an organ limerick, originated in print in 1939. It may have been in spoken circulation earlier. In 1940-something, when Senior and Wally are saying it to each other, it would have been only a few years old. Page 294, referring to Homer's biology class. Benjamin Arthur Bensley's Practical Anatomy of the Rabbit is a real book, published by the University of Toronto Press in 1918. Bensley is a clear, no-nonsense writer. His book, which he calls An Elementary Laboratory Textbook in Mammalian Anatomy, employs the anatomy of the rabbit as an introduction to an understanding of human anatomy. Bensley's is not Gray's, but Practical Anatomy of the Rabbit is a good book of its kind. As a very elementary student of anatomy, I learned a lot from Bensley.